Greetings. This is Pastor David Bass at New Geneva Orthodox Presbyterian Church with a moment of truth where we challenge you to think through an important issue of life and faith. And today, I'd like to launch a new series in conjunction with our own church's ministry. And that series is entitled Marriage Matters. What have I done by saying I do? This is a series on Christian biblical marriage. What have I done by saying I do? Now, as so many of you know, there is a great deal of confusion and distortion with resultant pain and misery when it comes to marriage in our culture. What is marriage anyway? Why is it necessary? Why can't we just open the floodgates, for example, for same-sex marriages? Why do we need marriage at all? Why can't my significant other and I just live together happily ever after, or as long as we both find it convenient to do so? Now, as I counsel both married and about-to-be-married couples, and I've had the great privilege of counseling many, many couples, well over 50, there's often this confusion and ambiguity over what marriage is and what their particular role may be in this venerable institution. And more often than not, it's the guy who says, "What have I done by saying I do?" And he usually does this shortly before or shortly after the wedding in a kind of cold sweat with that deer in the headlights look in the eyes. Women and girls, and I know that I'm just broadly generalizing a bit here, but women and girls grow up thinking a lot more about it than boys and are generally more prepared for marriage than their male counterparts, though not always. There are a variety of reasons, too, for this confusion and ambiguity about marriage, not the least of which is the utter lack of a true model set before our young people, which model is then taught and inculcated to the next generation. Instead, we have a cacophony of voices out there clamoring for recognition and for definition of marriage, don't we? For example, Jack and Jill live up the hill without a marriage license, and there's a lot more shacking up that's going on, isn't there? Or maybe Priscilla and Jill are off the pill and getting a sperm from a donor, perhaps. Lesbian couples are getting pregnant, aren't they, and having children? Or maybe John and Don have bought a farm, and they want to adopt a bevy of boys. That is, homosexuals increasingly demand the so-called right to marriage. And recently, we've even observed that plural marriage in the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I realize there's a distinction from the LDS Church in general, the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is back in the news too. Is everything up for grabs? Is that what this means? Or is there a true consistent model for marriage wired into the soul of our race? And I would submit that there is, and that that model is the covenant model, unfolded for us in the Bible and taught and inculcated for generations in the Christian West, but largely lost in the recent past. And this is due largely to the abdication of responsibility by the church. I lay this primarily responsibility-wise at the feet of the church. Now, if the church led her culture instead of following it, marriage would not be in the dire straits in which we find it. In the past, the church spoke prophetically to its surrounding culture and society and called it to biblical principles. The eloquent poetry of Genesis, for example, contains the seed of covenant marriage, where God said, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Nowadays, more and more 20-somethings, for example, are delaying marriage and living at home, sponging off mom and dad in an increasingly turbulent world. Perhaps you have one of those children in your own home. Now, the median age at first marriage is currently 26.9 years of age for males and 25.3 years of age for females. Now, those ages keep going up with each passing decade. That used to be much lower in decades past. And now, as well, for example, instead of cleaving to his wife, that man is increasingly subject to the prospects of divorce, which is currently estimated by the National Center for Health Statistics to be at about 43%, the rate of divorce in America. Now, you must realize that the commonly cited figure of 50% for our divorce rate is a skewed figure, a popular figure, but skewed. And it is skewed owing to several reasons, and I would refer you to the National Center for Health Statistics abstract. They have a statistical abstract that you can resource and find out why some of these figures are skewed, but not the least of which is that divorces have actually decreased in the last decade. That's good news. No longer 50%, but closer to 43% nationally. This is a salutary trend. Nevertheless, this figure of 43% of all marriages newly contracted ending in divorce is a startling and disgraceful figure, as far as I'm concerned, for a supposedly Christian nation. But lest you think that it's different for Christians than for non-Christians, let me pop that bubble for you. You may be familiar with George Barna, who is a Christian researcher. He specializes in statistics. He founded the Barna Institute, and he has demonstrated in a recent study, which has been controversial, by the way, that divorce rates are actually higher, closer to 48%, among self-identified born-again Christians, higher than in the national population in general. In fact, they are higher for these same Christians than for atheists and agnostics, who, ironically, have the lowest divorce rates of any self-identified religious group. Dr. Barna, in his study, confessed, he says this, and I quote him, "We rarely find substantial differences between the moral behavior of Christians and non-Christians," unquote. This, I would suggest, is precisely because the church has chosen to follow the culture in this crucial area, the area of marriage, rather than lead the culture. The church already follows the culture in its worship, for example, and by this I mean the whole contemporary worship model followed in most churches, and the church also follows in her music, tacking on Christian as an adjective to secular styles, whether it's Christian rock or Christian country or even Christian metal. And it does this rather than leading by creating her own distinctive music, as the church used to do. Just study the history of music and you'll discover that the entire tradition of Western music was founded in the churches. And consequently, the church in America also follows in being generally as materialistic and self-centered as her secular counterparts. This is as true for marriage as it is for materialism. It is as true for family as it is for fame and fortune. And the upshot for the Barna Institute is quite sobering when it comes to the effectiveness of the church, too. Barna says again, and I quote him, "Our data challenges the idea that churches provide truly practical and life-changing support for marriage," unquote. And I would agree wholeheartedly here. Merely adding a counselor to a church's staff, for example, is a pathetic band-aid measure. And the occasional sermon series on marriage only rubs salt in the wounds for most couples. And reading all of the Christian books in the world on marriage only makes of such a one a well-read sinner and divorcee. One writer says, and I quote him now, "Many people who are miserable in their marriages are also those who have read all the books." In fact, when it comes to the state of the evangelical church in modern America, I agree wholeheartedly with George Barna's conclusions. And he says, "Our results raise questions regarding the effectiveness of how churches minister to families," unquote. And for these reasons, then, and much, much more, I just happen to love the whole biblical notion of covenant marriage. And for that reason and many, many more, New Geneva Orthodox Presbyterian Church has found it necessary, and we are more than willing to do what we can to recover the biblical model for marriage. This has been one of our joys and passions throughout our life as a church. And I must confess to you, by way of personal testimony too, that the closer that I cleave to the model of the covenant marriage, the happier I am as a husband and a father. For those of you perhaps just entering the marriage stream, young, newlywed, perhaps being only a few years into it, let me encourage you to follow the biblical model, the covenant way of marriage, to the very end. I'm here today as a man of faith who has followed the pattern of biblical marriage in the scriptures as the covenant way. And by this I mean to distinguish the covenant way from the common evangelical born-again vanilla model of American cultural marriage that you find in most American churches. No, I mean the covenant way. And I'm here to tell you that God is faithful in rewarding obedience to it. I here and now give thanks for my covenant wife of some 27 years, Deborah. And I here and now give thanks to God for three successful covenant children, all of whom, in the words of the Apostle John, I can say, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. They're not just saved in the evangelical sense that they went forward in a meeting once and made a profession of faith, my kids, but then otherwise indistinguishable from their secular counterparts. No, our kids continue to walk in the covenant way of which we speak. God is faithful and will, O Christian, in general, reward those who are faithful in following the covenant way of marriage. But you may ask, what is this covenant way of which you speak? Well, let me begin by briefly defining what we mean by covenant. In the Bible, a covenant is simply, and I use the definition of O.P. Robertson, he says, a covenant is a bond in blood, sovereignly administered, unquote. So, when it comes to marriage, the parties to a covenant are bound together in a lifetime commitment. And although there is no shedding of blood per se, it is recognized, even as the Bible acknowledges that covenants are sealed in blood because the life is in the blood, as Leviticus 17 tells us, so by its very nature, marriage entails that the bodies and lives and souls and fortunes of those married are bound together inextricably for a lifetime. This is the idea behind them becoming one flesh. A covenant is also sovereignly administered, that is, in that God is the acknowledged king of the covenant, and he also then, by virtue of being king of the covenant, sets its terms and conditions. Thus, the covenant way of marriage is the bond between a Christian man and woman that models the union between Christ and his church before heaven and earth, which in turn bears joyful fruit in an holy seed, as our standards, our doctrinal standards, the Westminster Confession of Faith calls it, an holy seed for the church, in order that we might be obedient to the creation command to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, taking dominion of it. Let me repeat that definition then of what I mean when I talk about the covenant way of marriage. The covenant way of marriage is the bond between a Christian man and woman, not man and man or woman and woman, but between a Christian man and woman that models the union between Christ and his church. Every marriage, either in a good way or a bad way, models the union between Christ and his church before heaven and earth. We witness before heaven and earth our marriages, which marriage in turn bears joyful fruit in an holy seed for the church, that is, children, in order that we might be obedient to the creation command to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and take dominion of it. This brief definition will temper all that we say in the future about marriage. It will guide what we say about the roles of husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, children and in-laws, mamas and outlaws, for that matter. But it is a definition in contrast to our culture. Now, I heard a popular TV self-help guru define marriage in this way once. He said, it's a relationship based on love between two persons and recognized by society, unquote. Well, let me ask you, what will happen to a marriage based solely on human love? We see the detritus of broken marriages based on human love all around us, don't we? Why does the human heart as well ache for recognition of their union by others, too? We see this in our society, and we will explore these and other related questions fully in weeks to come. But leave it to say that this kind of vague, generic notion of marriage based on human love is sufficient for our contemporary culture, isn't it? And it's sufficient for most of the contemporary church as well. As it does with all other aspects of its life, the contemporary church tacks on the adjective Christian to it and calls what it practices Christian marriage, perhaps adding some pious bromides and recommendations to the notion of human love. Perhaps there is a consciousness that maybe God takes marriage more seriously than the friends we run with, and so we should get married in a church and maybe go there once in a while. But essentially, functionally, the contemporary notion of Christian marriage is still based upon human love. Thus, when the true tests of marriage fall upon them in the course of life, financial stresses, are there financial stresses in your marriage, sexual tensions perhaps, or differences in how to raise children, or whether to have children at all? Well, when these stresses of marriage come upon them, men and women respond reflexively with the answers built into them by their model. And that's a secular American cultural model. And in the end, couples find that the mere human love they saw as indestructible when they were dating, and I just have so many young couples come in and sit there before me, and you can see, in spite of what you're telling them, oh, their love is different. Love conquers all. And none of that stuff you're describing will happen to us, Pastor. Our love is too strong. Well, in the end, couples find that mere human love is no match for the stresses of marriage any more than Elmer's glue is sufficient for holding a railroad bridge together. And occasionally, couples get very serious about the Bible, and they go a little deeper, perhaps. They discover some concrete truths about marriage in the Bible. That, for instance, it's between a man and a woman, and that one must remain true to his or her spouse, and perhaps that God frowns upon divorce, too. They discover that there maybe are fruitful principles for getting along with their spouse and for even raising their children. And there is more hope for such marriages. Serious, born-from-above Christians who follow these biblical principles have a far greater chance of successful, God-glorifying marriages than their secular counterparts. But oftentimes, these truths for life come to them in a kind of piecemeal fashion as isolated facts, separate parts of marriage that float around in life like an auto parts store set free in outer space, rather than in a whole integrated vehicle that runs like a fine-tuned sports machine on the highway. Well, the covenant way of marriage, I submit to you, is that way of the fine-tuned sports machine built for the highway of life. And if you are one of those born-from-above Christians out there today who is serious about marriage, and have perhaps taken seriously some of the biblical truths I have mentioned, do not neglect the overarching structure of marriage that integrates, properly relates all of the separate parts of marriage into a fine-tuned whole. Now, I have found that even the strong Christian who takes seriously the biblical principles of marriage is oftentimes susceptible to the stresses of marriage precisely because he is not as strong as he could be with the parts of marriage welded together into an integrated whole as it was intended to be. Thus, sometimes tragically, even strong Christians find their marriages failing, ending in divorce or maybe even a kind of sullen truce in a distant misery over the long years of married life. But Pastor, I hear some people say, we just weren't compatible. Things didn't work out like we'd hoped. Divorce isn't so bad. The kids will survive and God will understand. After all, my salvation isn't linked to whether I stay married or not. I hear these kinds of things. I continue to hear these things. And when I do, I know that, despite the protestations and testimonies to the contrary, this relationship was functionally built upon the mere human love and not biblical love and the covenant way. This is a strong and persistent drive in the human heart, isn't it? Human love. Follow your heart. Oh, trust your instincts. Do what comes naturally. These are all cliches in our culture, and in one way or another, through advertising and education and entertainment, it gets drummed into us from childhood. When the passion and feeling wells up from deep within us, why, that in and of itself is good and true and shouldn't be denied. While perhaps this deep feeling and passion should be controlled, it must nevertheless be acted upon and can be trusted to be a guide in one's life. So our human reasoning goes. To deny human love and passion is to deny life itself, according to the poets. In fact, we might say that the poets have had more to do with the formation of modern notions of love than we may realize. In fact, There are three founding myths of modern love. I'd like to review those quickly with you for just a moment. There are three founding myths of modern love. See if you recognize these in your own life and your own heart and mind, for example. There's the Cinderella myth. Oh, the nasty Cinderella myth, guys. How many little girls grow up anticipating that their love life will be like that of Cinderella? Someday my prince will come. Someday he will come and sweep me off my feet, of course, after fitting me with glass slippers. I may be trapped here, little girls think. I may be trapped here in reality right now. And, of course, reality is pictured in Cinderella, in metaphor by Cinderella's cruel stepmother and stepsisters. Well, I may be trapped here in reality right now, but if I wait long enough, and you notice the passive role of Cinderella here, if I wait long enough, my prince will come searching for me and he'll liberate me. He will know and anticipate all of my needs and wants, and he'll take me away from all of this, and we will live happily ever after in a great castle. Well, every little girl knows this myth and integrates it in some way, shape, or fashion into her worldview as she grows up. And boys end up paying dearly if they do not follow the script of this myth. But essentially, the Cinderella myth is a myth of human love, isn't it? Subject to all of the faults and stresses of human love. Secondly, there's also the Romeo and Juliet myth. The Romeo and Juliet myth. There's an old rock and roll song from the 60s that I remember, Just Like Romeo and Juliet by the Reflections. Now, in that song, the young Romeo is going to buy a car in which he can date his Juliet, and he's going to buy her presents. And so great will be the passion of their love that, as the refrain goes, our love's going to be written down in history, just like Romeo and Juliet. Now, the reason this myth is so appealing and has survived and thrived in our culture, in song and movie and magazine, is because its guiding principle is extreme human passion, isn't it? Romeo and Juliet, extreme human passion. In the face of all obstacles and opposing society and families that just don't understand, Romeo and Juliet come together and live their passion and express their love no matter what. Modern Americans love this stuff. These kids are young and beautiful and rebellious. Just like American teenagers, they question and challenge authority, and they do everything to excess, just like Romeo and Juliet. However, there was one great point which Shakespeare intended to make, but which is lost on modern America. Romeo and Juliet spend their short, sweet life in misery, and then very soon die. Romeo and Juliet die. Their excesses bring them nothing but misery in life, and in the end, bear the fruit of death. How many modern American relationships do just that? They adopt this principle and integrate it into their worldview. That is extreme human passion that is expressed at all costs, regardless of the consequences, and ends up precisely in this way, misery and even death. In the end, as attractive and powerful as Romeo and Juliet and its myth may be, it is one based upon mere human love and passion. Be wary of it, O listener. Then there is, lastly, the Friends myth from the sitcom Friends. This is a contemporary postmodern myth that has as its guiding principle easy noncommittal commitment, if we can use that oxymoron, noncommittal commitment. Here, as in the TV sitcom of the same name, everyone is just friends. We hang out together. We're there for each other when we need each other, and we may even flow in and out of serious relationships with each other, but no one is ready for capital C commitment. Marriage is a taboo four-letter word never to be spoken among friends. We do not want to make the same mess of our lives that our parents did. It is postmodern, this myth, in that we realize that our parents' way of doing things only ended up in hypocrisy and misery and divorce, and some of us are even children of divorce, so we aren't going to pretend anymore, and we will just be natural and be friends. Less pain that way, safer that way, easier that way. We'll make up the rules as we go along, and who knows what will happen. So goes the Friends myth. And it not only generated a long-running sitcom for TV, but it also very cleverly captured the founding myth of a generation. But it, too, is a myth built upon mere human love and will end up creating shallow, selfish adults who have not yet and never will outgrow their childhood. a generation of friends who base their existence upon the contradiction of easy, non-committal commitment will be a contradiction to history, and they will quietly and miserably, albeit in a friendly fashion, pass from the earth. It is important for us to be aware of from whence we have come in order for us to know whither we go. And these three founding myths have guided, tragically, the thinking and living of generations of Americans and their marriages, Christian and non-Christian alike. Know them, O Christian, and begin to emerge from them in your mind and your heart, as dear as they may be to your heart, as much as you may have staked your life and future and marriage and romance upon them. They are all, in the last analysis, myths based upon mere human love. And what I want to leave you with in this introduction, and this is an introduction to a series, remember, is an awareness of something and someone who transcends mere human love and thus serves as a guarantor of a relationship as it was designed to be. That someone and something is the living God of the Bible and his covenant of marriage. There is a real and abiding design for marriage, and it will dawn on you like finding the owner's manual for your car in the glove compartment, that the vehicle, if you will, of your marriage will hum and move down the highway of life when you begin to follow it. Some people wince and they withdraw when they're initially confronted with the prospect of having to submit their lives and marriages to the seeming narrow rules of some ancient god and his book. Cinderella wouldn't do it, Romeo and Juliet wouldn't do that, and Rachel and Monica and Phoebe and Ross and Chandler on Friends certainly wouldn't do it. But that assumes, of course, that design and form and shape, and that is essentially what covenant does. It designs and forms and shapes a relationship. It assumes that that is bad. Now, no one would tolerate a car without design and form and shape. A car without design and form and shape is a lump of random piecemeal steel. Likewise, no one would tolerate a house without design and form and shape. A house without design and form and shape is just a pile of random piecemeal lumber. And yet we seem to tolerate marriages without design and form and shape. But yet a relationship without design and form and shape is what we have in most of modern America. That is a pile of random piecemeal feelings and passions. In a manner of speaking, God's covenant is the design and form and shape for marriage. Your very nature as well complements and fits that design and form and shape. You were wired, designed, made to hum and flow in that covenant. And it will not constrict and limit and stifle your nature. No, no, no. Rather, it will open up possibilities and dreams and feelings that you will never know or appreciate until you do conform to that shape and form and design. That is the design of the covenant way of marriage. The God of the Bible is the maker and designer of that covenant. It was made to complement and enable the creature he has made. That is you. God is your creator, and he loves you as a Christian. He wants to do good unto you and bless you, and he will do so. And God blessed them, Genesis tells us, after God had first made man and woman and performed the first wedding ceremony in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve bore fruit and multiplied, the text tells us, and that is your design and your purpose too, listener, as you conform to the covenant way. You will bear fruit in more than one way, not only in bearing children, but in the hollow of your soul. You will find joy and contentment in the wife of your youth, as Solomon calls her in the Proverbs. Your work and your labor, which you do under the sun, as Solomon describes these things in Ecclesiastes, will also bear fruit. So much of your purpose as a living being will hum and flow when you finally begin to get it right. I testify as a Christian pastor and most of all as a husband and father that God indeed has good things for you as you discover how you are wired for marriage and family. We are presently, as a church at New Geneva, going through a series on marriage and family, and we invite you to come and study these things with us. We at New Geneva Orthodox Presbyterian Church have a blend of seasoned families who know and have lived this covenant way for generations, and we have young families and single people, for that matter, perhaps like you, who are just discovering these things and are on a fast track towards reforming their marriages. We are accomplishing these things within the context of our Sunday school hour. Begins about noon on Sundays. We invite you, come and join us in conjunction with our fellowship meal. We invite you, if you are at all curious, to come and visit our church for worship at 10 a.m. and then perhaps retire with us downstairs for our Sunday school hour. This has been Pastor David Bass inviting you to do these things at New Geneva Orthodox Presbyterian Church with a moment of truth. New Geneva meets for holy worship on Sundays at 10 a.m. at 101 4th Street on the corner of 4th and Boulevard. Call us at 523-0196 or check out our website, newgenevaopc.org.